This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic and actor George Carlin. He has a new HBO comedy special that debuts November 5th. Carlin's best-selling book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops, has just come out in paperback. The book takes aim at two of Carlin's favorite targets, euphemistic language and political correctness. Carlin's most famous comedy monologue has become known as Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television. In 1973, the Pacifica radio station in New York, WBAI, played this monologue without bleeping those seven words. After a complaint was filed, the FCC put WBAI on notice, threatening possible sanctions against the station if subsequent complaints were received. WBAI appealed the decision. The case eventually made it to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the FCC and enabled the FCC to regulate the broadcast of indecent content. The decision became particularly relevant when the FCC tightened standards following Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction. Here's a 1972 recording of Carlin's monologue. We have, of course, bleeped the words that made this routine famous.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are seven of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you seven. Bad words. That's what they told us they were, remember?
That's a bad word.
No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions. And words. You know the seven, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, f***, suck a mother, huh? Those are the heavy seven. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
George Carlin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Can you talk about what led to this routine? Like what you were thinking about, how you wrote it?
Well, what happened was I'd always held these attitudes. I've always been sort of anti-authoritarian, and I really don't like arbitrary rules and regulations that are essentially designed to get people in the habit of conforming. And I have always taken great joy in looking closer, more closely, at language. On these other things, we get into the field of hypocrisy, where you really cannot pin down what these rules they want to enforce are. It's just impossible to say this is a blanket rule. You'll see some newspapers print F blank blank K. Some print F asterisk asterisk K. Some put expletive deleted. So there's no real consistent standard. It's not a science, and it's superstitious. These words have no power. We give them this power. It's the rest of the sentence that makes them either good or bad.
In your 1972 recording, you talk about how it's perfectly okay to say, don't prick your finger, but you can't say, don't finger your blank.
Yeah, you can't reverse the two
words. You can't reverse the two words. So comics work with the power of words. And in a way, the fact that certain words are supposed to be taboo, as you point out, that gives them power.
That's right.
And that makes those words more powerful for you when you want to use them. So do you feel like you've been able to work with the taboo nature of certain words and, you know, make that work in your favor?
Yeah, that is an interestingly a disguised way, and I don't mean you were trying to deceive me or anything, but it's in a disguised way of saying, well, don't some people just use these for shock value? You get this phrase all the time from interviewers, shock value. Well, shock is a kind of a heightened form of surprise, and surprise is at the heart of comedy. So if you're using the word in a way to heighten the impact of the sentence or season the stew, they are, after all, great seasonings. There are sentences that, without the use of hell or damn, even lose all their impact. So they have a proper place in language, and in my case, I just like them because they are real and they do have impact. They do make a difference in a sentence. But if you're using them for their own sake, that's probably kind of weak.
Did you ever expect that comedy routine would be actually played on the radio, and it would be part of a case that made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and that it would become as important and famous a case as it became?
Well, I knew that it wasn't out of the question that it may be played on the radio. FM radio stations at that time, and there were commercial ones, who qualified as what was called underground radio, and an awful lot of liberties were taken with music, too. Music that had very... I hate the words explicit and graphic, but those are the words that would be used by someone to describe those kind of songs, those lyrics. I knew there was a chance, but of course, no one ever sees other things coming that are unexpected and larger, you know. I just knew that I had done a piece that summed up my position very well and sort of had a nice, it had a wonderfully rhythmic, the reading of those seven words, the way they were placed together, had a magnificent kind of a jazz feeling, a rhythm that was just very natural and satisfying, the way those syllables were placed together. And so I knew I had done something that was making an important point about the hypocrisy of all of this.
Were you at the Supreme Court when the case was being argued?
No. No, I was an interested bystander. It wasn't my case. It generated a certain amount of attention for me, which I guess a performer never walks away from. But I decided very early not to try to either exploit the incident and the episode, or to walk away from it and disavow it. I just let it be as it was happening and let the results of it land wherever they would.
Does this surprise you still when you hear, say, the language that's used on The Sopranos or other HBO shows? You know, that it, you know, because the language that you could never say on broadcasting, and that you still can't say on broadcasting, you can say on cable, and now you can say it on satellite radio, which is where Howard Stern is moving, where Opie and Anthony have already moved. So, I mean, there are two different sets of standards, but does it surprise you to hear language coming from your television like that?
The interesting thing about it for me is this is how people talk. Not everyone, of course, but a significant number of people use these words all the time. And when I was a little boy, I was told to look up to, because it was just, there was the Second World War, I was born in 1937, I was taught to look up to soldiers and sailors, that's the only words you really used for the armed forces, soldiers and sailors, policemen, of course, and athletes. That was to develop a little more later. But these are the people you should model yourself after. These are the paragons of American value and virtue. Well, we all know how they talk. We all know how those three groups talk, the military, the athletes, and the police. And that to hear police shows all these years, and war movies all these years, without the sort of language they were using, immediately branded them as inauthentic to me. Largely, I thought, that's not what he would say. That's not what he would like. I think he would say it like this. So it's just inauthentic. It's a counterfeit representation of real life that these commercial and religious interests impose on, or try to impose on people.
Do you remember how you were first exposed to four-letter words and what your reaction was when you first were?
Well, I was. I grew up in a part of New York City that's a very interesting neighborhood. I lived literally, my front door was across the street. I mean literally in its real sense here. Literally across the street from Teachers College of Columbia University. And all around me to the south, I had Columbia University, Teachers College, Barnard College. Juilliard School of Music was around the corner, the original location. Riverside Church, the 23-story interdenominational cathedral, the Gothic cathedral, was at the end of my street. Union Theological Seminary, the largest seminary in the world. And around the corner, the Jewish Theological Seminary, the largest Jewish seminary in the world. St. John the Divine was nearby, and Grant's tomb. So it was a highly institutional neighborhood full of learning and serious people. Immediately to the north, down the hill, we had the beginnings of Harlem. We called our section White Harlem because we thought it sounded tough. But there were cross-pollination between these two groups. I lived very close by Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans on the one hand, and blacks on the other. And when you're in those neighborhoods at the border, ours was a little Irish enclave, just a little wedge-shaped Irish enclave in the middle of all that. Highly populated because we were quite fertile folks. A lot of kids on the street. And when you live near the border between all black and all white, you don't have the attitudes that the people who are insulated and isolated in the center of those areas have. Those are people who are not in contact day to day with the opposite. But we did have contact all the time. And when you're on the border between two cultures, you sort of learn to live together. You have a common code of the streets in this case. And so I heard my language from the realistic people in the neighborhood, my big brother for one. But that's where I got a realistic feel and look at the world.
Did language get you into trouble as a kid?
Well, because I liked language, as I sang, my grandfather wrote out all of the works of Shakespeare in his adult life, longhand, because of the joy it gave him. Those were his words. But I then started collecting exotic combinations of curses that I heard in my neighborhood. I was probably 13 or 14 at the time. And there were guys who would put together a sentence in the heat of anger or in some ornate descriptive passage in something they were describing. And they would have an adjective or two. They would be self-hyphenated. They would have made up a form and tacked it on to some noun that it didn't really go with. And the rest of the sentence might have been some colorful verb that was, again, very inventive street language. And some of them were very colorful and exotic and different. They weren't just flat-out curses. So I heard these, and I started writing them down. In another situation where I could tell you what they were, you'd understand a little better even what I mean. But I wrote them down, and I had a little list of them. I had about 10 or 12 of them. There are a few I can still remember. But I've had that in my wallet. And my mother was a snoop and discovered things I had stolen that way and confronted me with them. But in this case, looking in my wallet, she found this list. And I heard her. I came in one night, and I opened the door very slightly in the apartment on the second floor, and I heard her talking to my Uncle John, and she was worried about me anyway because I was kind of I was getting like a loose cannon kind of a adolescent. And I heard her saying, "I think he may need a psychiatrist, John. I think we may have to get a child psychologist for him," because she was telling him these words and showing him this list. So, yeah, they got me in trouble that way, but at least it was a creative effort.
Although your mother was appalled finding this list of street words in your wallet, you earlier credited your mother with having a love of language and helping to instill it in you. How did her love of language express itself?
She was wonderful, and she was my hero. She brought up two boys in the Second World War in an advertising job she had, and I had no father present in the home. And she stimulated that thing in me about language. She would send me to the dictionary. I mean, that's pro forma in a lot of families. I know that's what you do. But she would say, "Get the dictionary." I asked her once what peruse meant. I said, "Ma, what's peruse?" She said, "Well, get the dictionary in here. Let's get the dictionary." So I'd look it up, and she'd have me use it in a sentence of my own. And we talk about the root or the origin of it and which definition was more useful and current and so forth. And so the next day, when I gave her her newspaper, in the evening it wasn't a nightly custom, but sometimes I went and bought her a newspaper and she came home from work, I brought it in her bedroom and gave her the newspaper. And I said, "Here, Ma," I said, "would you like to peruse this?" And she said, "Well, maybe I'll give it a cursory glance." And it was right back to the dictionary.
My guest is comic George Carlin. His best-selling book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops, has just come out in paperback, and his 13th HBO comedy special debuts November 5th. Our interview was recorded last November. This is Fresh Air. Phew, well, we got through that interview without saying anything that would get us into trouble with the FCC, but it's great to talk with people like George Carlin who provoke you and get you thinking while they get you laughing. Let's get back to our interview with comic George Carlin. Now, I know you made it onto radio before you became famous as a comic. What was your radio persona?
Well, I was on the first job I had was in a place, Shreveport, Louisiana, which sounds like kind of an easily ignored place, but it had 9 stations. It was a hot radio market, as they said, and we were number one. I had a 52 share. So it was top 40, but it wasn't as rigid as top 40 became. It wasn't as it didn't sound like a robot time temperature and the label and the name of the artist. You could be a little bit of a personality too. So we played top 40, and I was I was only 18. It was great to be playing the very music that I was dancing to at night. It was nice to go over to a girl in a situation like at a bar or something and say, would you like me to play a song on the radio for you tomorrow and dedicate it to you? It was a little underhanded, but it sure worked.
Works like a charm. And yeah. Would you talk your way through the instrumental up to the vocal of the record?
Some of the time, sure. Yeah, use the first 8 bars or 16 bars or whatever the instrumental intro was. You bring it up first for about 3 or 4 seconds, then you bring it down and say, okay, the new Connie Francis just came in. And I'm exaggerating my disc jockey voice. And here at 15 minutes past 5 on the George Carlin Show on KJO, we're going to listen to this brand new one and then whoo, up with the vocal, you know? I loved running a tight board. We ran our own boards, and I was so proud of tight cues and segues that were tight, you know? It was just a point of pride.
Who were the first comics that you heard where you thought they nailed it? This is what life is about. Like they just described life.
Of course, comedy changed in the 1950s when the individuals emerged and nobody was all the same anymore. It used to be very sane, very safe, and very same. And then Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Nichols and May, and a lot of other people in the improv groups and some underground press and so forth took hold of comedy and changed it. And so it was that crop, and in the 50s I was then approaching my 20th birthday. And Lenny Bruce was, of course, the one who inspired me the most, because I saw for the very first time utter and complete honesty on a stage, and it really did help me later to decide to be myself.
How much do you think your comedy has changed from when you first started doing stand-up?
Well, I began in 1960. I went through about 8 or 9 years of what essentially were the extended 1950s, sort of a button-down period. But that was when the country was changing. I was 30 in 1957. The people I was entertaining were in their 40s, and they were the parents of the people who were 20, 18, in college, beginning to change the nature of our society to a great extent. So I sided more with them because I was anti-authority, and I just let myself revert to my deferred adolescence and be one of them in terms of my work, rather than these people I really disliked who I was entertaining, these 40-year-old plus people.
Were you performing to older audiences because those were the people who could buy the tickets in the places that you were performing?
No, not strictly speaking. I had always been this lawbreaker, outlaw type kid and adolescent and Air Force guy, as you pointed out. But I had a mainstream dream, and my dream was to be like Danny Kaye in the movies, or to be like Bob Hope in the movies. So I never put those two things together. I never saw that they didn't go together. And I followed this other dream in the way that you did, because the only way you could do it was to please people with mainstream safe comedy. That's what the period demanded and got. So I did that until it became an untenable situation. I could no longer be myself inside and serve these other things. And when I saw the mix, when I saw the mistake, I went about correcting it in a slow and orderly manner. It took about 2 or 3 years for my changes, as it were, to take place.
Well, George Carlin, I'd like to ask you to end our interview by reading the final piece in your new book. And the book is called When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? And this piece is called The Secret News.
I have a big file called News, and it has a lot of odd news formats, and one of them was this one called The Secret News. And this was actually written and designed to be on an album, maybe a studio type album where you could use sound effects and you were simulating actual broadcasting, but it works this way too. It's called The Secret News, and we hear a news ticker sound effect, ding, 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 and the announcer whispering, saying, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's time for the secret news. And the news ticker gets louder, and he goes, shh, and the ticker lowers. Here is the secret news. All people are afraid. No one knows what they're doing. Everything is getting worse. Some people deserve to die. Your money is worthless. No one is properly dressed. At least one of your children will disappoint you. The system is rigged. Your house will never be completely clean. All teachers are incompetent. There are people who really dislike you. Nothing is as good as it seems. Things don't last. No one is paying attention. The country is dying. God doesn't care. Shh.
George Carlin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you. I always appreciate, I'm not flattering here, an intelligent interview, and thank you for that.
George Carlin's book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops, has just come out in paperback. His 13th HBO comedy special debuts November 5th. Our interview was recorded last November. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.